Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Naomi Starkman, Communications and Policy Director for Slow Food Nation, the largest celebration of food in America taking place in San Francisco over Labor Day weekend. This program tonight is part of our How We Eat series, an in-depth look at our eating habits, health, and the mechanisms surrounding how we get our food. Tonight, we are in conversation about eating the right way, and we will address how each one of us can do so, not just for ourselves and our families, but also for the earth. Each of tonight's panelists is an expert in creating a platform highlighting the critical connection between plate and planet. Our panelists tonight, Jessica Prentice, a professional chef, local food activist, and author. She coined the word locavore and co-created the Local Foods Wheel. In 2006, Jessica joined four partners in founding Three Stone Hearth, a community-supported kitchen that uses local, sustainable ingredients to prepare nutrient-dense traditional foods on a community scale. Three Stone Hearth will be sampling fermented vegetables and cultured beverages at Slow Food Nation and also hosting a slow dinner at the Slow Club in San Francisco. Kevin Lunny is co-owner and president of Drake's Bay Oyster Farm, which raises grass-fed organic beef, artichokes, oysters, and clams. His company is recognized for environmental stewardship, marine conservation, and pasture management. Kevin is a third-generation family rancher and farmer in Point Reyes, California. Helene York, director of the Bon Appetit Management Company Foundation, whose mission is to educate consumers and chefs about how their food choices affect the global environment and to catalyze supply chain changes. Helene is a national expert on the food system's contribution to climate change and the architect of Bon Appetit's low-carbon diet program, which seeks to reduce emissions associated with food service operations by 25% over 5 years. Bon Appetit Management Company is also a lead sponsor of Slow Food Nation. Tonight's conversation, organic, locally grown, sustainable, low carbon, these are just a few of the media buzzwords you might have heard. During the past decade, U.S. organic sales have grown 20% or more annually. But there's more to eating than just organic, a term itself that has come under question for being co-opted by big business. How can we as communities feed ourselves in ways that are both sustainable and sustaining? How can we feed ourselves in ways that are deeply nutritious and nourishing to our bodies, ecologically wise, economically viable, and socially enhancing? I'd like to open today's discussion by asking each of the panelists to answer this question. What does eating the right way mean to you? And in asking this question, please tell us how your individual work contributes to this goal. Helene, I'd like to start with you.
Thank you, Naomi, and I just want to say that I'm very honored to be here. I have to say that I really chuckled when I heard the title of this panel, Eating the Right Way. I run a program that makes the connection between food and climate change, and I'm often accused of suggesting that people should eat the left way as a very political act. We don't think it's a political act, but let me use the words of Carlo Petrini, founder of Slow Food, who said recently that an environmentalist who is not a gastronome is sad. But a gastronome who is not an environmentalist is stupid. And I think that really sums up in many ways Bon Appetit's approach to food and food sourcing. And it really is philosophy of the company and the foundation that I direct that really looks at where our food comes from, what we should be serving, what is ethically sound from an environmental perspective, from a humane perspective, from a guest's perspective. I mean, who is eating our food and what they should be eating. As a company that serves 80 million meals a year, we have a special responsibility because we do have some power to affect food choices and affect the supply chain. But we also have a special opportunity to educate the guests at our cafes to know more about their food choices and to make choices when they're at supermarkets or at farmers markets or preparing meals for their families at home as well as eating at our cafes. 10 years ago, the chefs of the company asked themselves the question, why are these tomatoes not tasting like the tomatoes we grew up with? Why are the melons not tasting the way they're supposed to? And the realization, the result of those questions, was a commitment to local food sourcing. We have 400 cafes in 29 states now. And each cafe is responsible for sourcing at least 20% of their food from within 150 miles of every kitchen. We operate cafes in Minnesota and Maine and Arizona and lots of places where growing seasons are short. And so 20% is not an insignificant amount when you're serving 80 million meals a year. But I'm very proud to say that we're actually up to 38% of local sourcing. And that has everything to do with empowering the chefs to make decisions about good food, about a corporate commitment, certainly, to set the standards and the tone. But this really is about chefs getting engaged in these issues, getting their guests engaged in these issues, so that it's a cycle of supporting the local producers. We have chefs who sit down with farmers in January and talk about what they're going to grow and guarantee that they're going to buy everything that grows or doesn't grow on that field. We have chefs that give their kitchen trimmings, the waste from the outer husks of broccoli and so forth, the outer husks of melons, either to pig farmers or to farmers to take back and compost. It's a cycle. And what this is really about is creating a cycle as tight as possible. Even though we consider local to be 150 miles, that's because we have a national standard. Many of our cafes, many of our kitchens, many of our chefs believe that local is more 50 to 60 miles. It's about the resources, the regional resources that are available to them. After the local sourcing commitment was made, it really opened up for our chefs an understanding that there were a lot more things wrong with the food system than simply the lack of good-tasting tomatoes or melons or enough stewards of the land and the sea to be able to bring us and sell us those products that were tasty as we remembered them. Farm animals are routinely and prophylactically raised with antibiotics to promote growth rather than to treat disease. Oceans are overfished. And many aquacultural programs, very happy to say not shellfish here in the Bay Area, but many aquacultural programs are making matters worse rather than better, and we need them to be good. And hen-laying eggs are raised in utterly inhumane conditions. So for Bon Appetit Management Company, eating the right way or the left way or the way that we think is the most responsible is about buying animal proteins that are raised without the prophylactic use of antibiotics or growth-promoting hormones, having a strict standard for buying seafood that meets very strict sustainability criteria, and we follow the Monterey Bay Aquarium standards, and cage-free shell eggs that are also certified humane. But what I think our contribution, and I'll just wrap this up because I don't want to monopolize this, is that when we looked at these issues, we catalyzed supply chain changes. That's not consistent throughout the United States. We in the Bay Area have some advantages that many people around the country do not have, but that has been the effect of a lot of our work, is really trying to change national supply chains. Is that when we realize that there's a whole nother edge to this. And what is sustainable in one region, such as wild Pacific salmon, is really not sustainable if it's eaten on the East Coast and it is flown 3,000, 5,000, 6,000 miles away. That there is more to having food that's seasonal, regional, local. There's also an inherent contribution that the food system makes to our changing climate, that it is our responsibility as responsible food providers to change, to raise awareness, to raise questions, to catalyze supply chain changes. Our low-carbon diet program is fundamentally about raising questions, teaching our chefs about what foods are more intensive in their absorption of energy versus how much they put out, either in calories or any other way you look at it. There are foods that are much more responsible for contributing to climate change than others. And the sheer volume of food and the amount that's wasted throughout all steps of the process is a significant cause of climate change impacts. So as we work with chefs to change what they menu, we are also now working with guests at our accounts to teach them how they can make choices and really help us menu differently. Because if they support us, then we can go even further. We have developed a tool, even though most of our work is internal to the supply chain or at our cafes, we've developed a public tool that's free online. It's at a website called eatlowcarbon.org, and it is a comparative tool for any consumer to use to understand the differences between different food choices and what kind of impact that has on climate change. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Naomi.
Thank you, Helen. Really, a substantial contribution is being made by your company, and obviously the food service industry is lucky to have you be part of it. Kevin, I was hoping you could also share with us sort of what you envision in terms of what eating the right way means to you and your business and the work that you're doing right now.
Sure. Well, it's interesting for me because it was an evolution that kind of got me interested in understanding what eating the right way really is. I'm a third-generation farmer, rancher, milking cows and raising beef cows. And in a conventional market, traditionally, feeding into a big national commodity market. And about 10 years ago, our children were about 8 or 10 years old. We have 20-year-old triplets. And we were sitting over the breakfast table, and I was talking to my mom and dad, and my wife, Nancy, was there, and we were discussing how difficult it is to make ends meet. Here we are producing a product that is priced nationally. Our children didn't know who got to enjoy our food. The finances were just bleak. And we did it because it's a beautiful life, but a very difficult living. Our kids asked questions, is this why you work off the farm, Dad? Because we can't make any money here? And we thought, well, there's not a chance our children are going to want to carry on this tradition. So what started with kind of an economic driver to look into maybe something different, maybe a niche product, introduce me into organic and sustainable food production, what that means to our bodies and our environment that soon became my deepest passion. And so my role that I think I play in helping people understand this is from the producer side. I'm president of the Marin Farmers Market Association because having an outlet for small family farms, we can't interest the big distributors with 200 cows. They're not interested in the small farm model because it just it can't sustain them, and they want to work with the big outfits. So what we've done is the more we work on this, the more we understand that it's all not only the answer for the environment, but it's the answer for survival of the small family farm. We've seen such a dramatic change into big industrial agriculture. We're losing over 50 farms a week across the nation. And so this is what can save the small family farm. And so that's a particular interest of mine. And another thing that we do work really closely with in our operation that Helene touched on is our responsibility when it comes to climate change and our carbon footprint as we produce food and how we can reduce that and somehow get that message to the eater that that's important, and that's a challenge that we have, is to understand enough to be able to share with knowledge that people can understand.
And I think that's a really important point, and I'm sure many people here today often find themselves overwhelmed with the sometimes confusing information about what to eat and how to eat. So hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on some answers today as well. Jessica, what is your definition of eating the right way?
Well, first I just want to say thank you for having me here tonight. It's really an honor to be here, and to also just recognize the work that both Helene and Kevin talked about, because both pieces are so important to the big picture. And did you say that you do 80 million meals
80
a
million.
Year?
Yeah.
That's a lot of meals, and the kinds of distribution changes that she's talking about in a food service company of that size is just hugely, hugely important. And one of the conversations we had before we came up here this evening was how important it is that the kinds of changes we're talking about tonight and the kinds of transformation that we're looking for in our food system has to be happening on all different levels. And absolutely, food services is and the sort of the corporate level is just such an important piece that we often miss or don't think about, because so much of that kind of work happens behind the scenes and we don't even really think about it. So I'm just really delighted to hear about a company that's looking at all those issues, that's setting those kinds of standards and supporting, more than anything, supporting their chefs to be able to take the extra time to do that kind of work, because it's just hugely important. And I know Kevin's work. I've had him to my business, and absolutely everything that we're talking about would be impossible if it weren't for the actual farmers and ranchers who are making these kinds of transformations on the farm. And I think when you start to hear about different ways to produce food, and there's sort of the one model where, you know, you raise a cow for three months, and then it gets put on a truck and taken to a feedlot and then to a slaughterhouse, and then you hear about another model where it gets finished on your own grass and maybe even slaughtered on farm and distributed directly to consumers through farmers markets or other means. As a consumer, you say, well, of course, if you're a rancher, you want to do plan B. You don't want to do plan A. And why do we even have plan A in the first place? But it's so important to realize that for farmers and ranchers, these kinds of changes are incredibly challenging. And especially if you're dealing with three generations of doing things one way, to make these transformations is a step-by-step process that comes from, starts with an inner shift that obviously happened with you. And I'm very privileged to hear these kinds of stories again and again. Somebody who's grown rice his entire life but has never tasted the rice that he grows, tasting it for the first time because they've started to do direct marketing and these kinds of things. So just my appreciation for both of these people's work and for Naomi's work as well, because the consumer education is so important. And in terms of my own work, I have obviously had a real passion for bringing local to the conversation, and you know the whole locavore word and the local foods wheel is really about people starting to understand what foods do grow where they live and what foods don't, and came out of my work at the farmers market, where people would come up to me and ask me where the mangoes were, or you know, the bananas, or you know, in December where the blueberries were, that kind of thing. And so I think on one important piece of all this is just that we grow up in a culture where everything's next to everything else in the big supermarket, and we don't know anymore. We've lost that knowledge of what is grown locally and when, and seasonality and all of that. And so bringing that knowledge of seasonality back to people is an important part of my work. But then my daily work now is with this community-supported kitchen, which is a small sort of community scale business. I did some quick math after I heard you throw out your figure, and I think we're serving about 52,000 meals a year. Yeah. so that very different scale, but not an insignificant scale either. When I did that math, I was kind of impressed. A lot of which are made with these hands, these two hands, and a wonderful piece of a really big skillet that I have at the kitchen. But what we're able to do on this kind of scale is buy as much as possible direct from ranchers, particularly all our animal products. We really try to source everything from pasture-based ranchers. So all of our beef is grass-fed, grass-finished, and I'm hoping that Kevin will talk a little bit about what that means in terms of you know, carbon footprint and all of that, because there's a huge difference between feedlot organic and grass-fed, grass-finished beef, pastured pork, pastured eggs. So not only cage-free, but chickens that are actually able to peck around in the grasses and be free in the coops, which is becoming. There's a movement to bring this back, but there's still few and far between eggs that are really raised that humanely, that freely. And certainly what we're doing in terms of both of those things would be pretty much at this point impossible on the scale that Bon Appetit is working. But we're kind of right on this community scale where we really can purchase that way. We buy our vegetables and fruit through sometimes directly from farmers, but mostly through a local organic distribution company called Veritable Vegetable. And I work very closely with them to try to source as locally as possible and to buy from the smallest farms that I possibly can. Dairy products also we buy a lot direct from farmers and ranchers. And another big piece of the business is to bring farmers and ranchers to the kitchen. We have monthly full moon feasts. Almost all of our food gets packed into mason jars and gets people order online, and then they come on a weekly basis and pick up a box of whatever they ordered, whatever they want. The mason jars are paid a deposit on, so they pay us $1.50 per jar, and then when they come back the next week, they bring all those jars back. We wash them and reuse them. So that's sort of the big bulk of our business is that model of people eating at home, but eating this very nutrient-dense food prepared from these local sustainable ingredients that we're actually able to build relationships with farmers and ranchers that are really supportive to those farmers and ranchers, because it's a scale that's worthwhile for them to work on. It's you know, Kevin was mentioning, you know, if you only have 200 cows, you know, who are you going to sell to? And we're actually at a scale where that works really, really well. So we're able to support all these farmers and ranchers. The people who order through us, our subscribers, are very, very passionate about the environment and eating locally and about supporting the farmers and ranchers. And then we also do these monthly full moon feasts where we bring, that's the last time I saw Kevin was he came out for a feast, and we bring a rancher, we prepare their food, and then I do an interview with them afterwards so people eat the food and then get to ask questions directly and hear how the food is raised. And that's just, to me, you know, almost one of the best parts of the business, because that's when the actual connection happens between consumers and producers, and people get to know this is where my food's being raised, this is the human face that's behind it. And if there's anything that to me is about eating the right way, it's really about eating within the context of relationship, where you, there's not the anonymity, but you have some sense of who raised the food, where it was raised, how it was raised, all of that.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing ways to eat right. Joining me in this discussion are Kevin Lunny, co-owner and president of Drake's Bay Oyster Farm, Jessica Prentice, co-founder of Three Stone Hearth, and Helene York, director of the Bon Appetit Management Company Foundation. And Helene, I wanted you to perhaps touch a little bit on what the low-carbon diet is. Maybe describe for the audience tonight what that is and what are examples of a low-carbon diet.
Okay. First, I have to say that I think it's really interesting that the three of us on this panel are all private sector food activists, which is not always the case when we're talking about environmental issues or even food issues. So I just wanted to note that. The low-carbon diet program is fundamentally about raising awareness of the connection of the food system to climate change and its very significant contribution. It's been estimated to be about a third of the world's greenhouse gases are embodied in the food system. That's a wide definition, lots of boundaries in that the definition, but any way you count it, it's very significant. The low-carbon diet program is, I would say, fundamentally about putting vegetables on the plate first. It is not about being a vegetarian or being a vegan or cutting out cheese completely, but it's saying let's have all those other lovely things as additives. We tend to think in the United States about what protein are we going to eat and then what starch, and if we get around to it, we think about vegetables. We also have kind of segregated meals into vegetarian and everything else, or really, you know, the dishes, and then there's the vegetarian dish. Fundamentally, the low-carbon diet program is about putting vegetables first and allowing guests and allowing customers, consumers, to choose what else to put on the plate afterwards. It's about eating the right-sized portions for our bodies. There's no prescriptive number of calories, and it's not about never eating ice cream. I can see you're all glad about that. It really is about saying some food products are greater contributors to others, to climate change, and we really need to just shift the balance of what we eat and how much that we eat and be mindful of our choices.
So perhaps you can just give us a few examples of foods that are high carbon, foods that are low carbon.
Well, oddly enough, the one that surprised us the most was rice. It was a very high-carbon food. It has a lot to do with the way it's cultivated because of the methane gas that is released in the perpetual flooding of the rice paddies. And that's the way almost all rice in the world is produced, not all of it, but most of it. But let me back up just by saying that this didn't come out of our imagination. We hired a science team in two universities to look at all of the published papers on this subject, on the life cycle assessment of different foods. So this was not about where it came from only. It was not about how it was produced only. Life cycle assessment is fundamentally about feed to fill. So if a plant or an animal is fed with corn or fertilizer, that's taken into account. And then the production process, the manufacturing, the heating, the refrigeration, the transportation, and then the waste at the end. So the fill is a landfill, because I can't think of a better way of saying feed to fill. That's a little bit more interesting. So I mean that whole spectrum. And those numbers were put together, and we compared these different food products. The interesting thing is how some foods are very high carbon, and I mean carbon dioxide equivalent, because the foods that are methane producers from ruminant animals, cheese, beef, lamb, are very high. And then there are many products that are very low, such as shellfish, such as most vegetables, unless they're coming by airplane. So really, the issue is more what you eat than where it comes from. But for those of us who are very conscious about where we eat, choosing where it comes from is a great next step. It's a very important part of the whole process.
And just to follow up on that, I know, Jessica, you mentioned that perhaps, Kevin, you could talk to a little bit about how grass-fed beef, the carbon impact that grass-fed beef has, and that's part of your production, but you also raise oysters, and as Helene mentioned, that's on the other end of the scale. So perhaps you can share with the audience a little bit about your experience and the differences in raising grass-fed beef, why that's an important food choice.
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, the typical beef is a huge carbon user, a big greenhouse gas producer. Typically and traditionally, we raise our calves on the ranch. We ship the calves, and they're shipped to another part of the country, and they'll be in a stocker operation. Then they'll be shipped again to the Midwest, where they're fed corn. This is where methane problems are, huge numbers of animals in small areas. Then they're shipped again to processing. And then they're distributed all over the nation. The average hamburger in this nation has traveled over 1,500 miles. Conversely, with grass-fed and grass-finished, the animal's born and raised on the ranch, and it's fed pasture. It's on the farm its whole life. It makes huge differences. I'm part of the Marin Carbon Project. We're looking at this very specifically. And that not only is it using a lot less carbon, properly managed pasture grazing. When we try to replicate the pasture, what the native ungulates, the native grazers might have done on our grasslands, our California native grasslands, they would move in big herds, big impact, mob grazing, and then they'd move on, and then there'd be nothing there. Well, as we replicate that kind of a grazing regime on our ranches through rotation, we find that not only do the pastures respond more and grow more grass means more photosynthesis. It means more carbon dioxide coming from the atmosphere. And properly timed, properly managed grazing can sequester huge amounts of carbon. So not only does it become better, it can actually help and work in reverse and start banking carbon that would otherwise be produced by the very same food.
Jessica, I was hoping that you could perhaps share with the audience a little about the local foods wheel.
Oh, well, yeah, so the wheel, I actually have one here, I'll pass it around so people can sort of play with it, was designed really to be a easy, pretty thing that you could have around your house that would show you what foods do grow locally and when. So the only way I can explain is to show it. Can I show it? Because it's a visual aid. So there's it's a moving wheel like this. The top layer of the wheel shows foods that are available year-round in the Bay Area. This is just for the San Francisco Bay Area. We're actually working on one for New York right now. And if that goes well, then we'll do them for other parts of the country. And then the bottom layer of the wheel is foods that are available seasonally, and then there's an opening. So you just turn the wheel to the season that you're in. Like right now we're in summer, and it will show you what foods are available during summer. So then basically everything that you can see in the white is what's available locally at this time of year. And actually one of the things that's been most exciting about this is how much it's turned out to help chefs, because even chefs have grown up in this culture that doesn't know anymore what's in season when or what grows locally. And I know lots of caterers who keep this in their, you know, their commercial kitchens and use it to figure out what they're going to serve at a certain time of year. So it's really just, it's an information tool. It's an education tool. There's also a more specific list on the back. So if you want to know when blueberries are in season, you can look under B for blueberries, and it'll tell you late May until July. And it was a real labor of love. Three of us here locally made it, an artist that did all the drawings and a graphics person that did the layout. And it was really just to sort of express the bounty of what is available locally and to encourage us to put those foods on the plate first, the local foods. And again, it's not about, never eating chocolate or coffee or using cinnamon or vanilla. All those things are wonderful too, but to start with the foods that are local and then to supplement with the foods that are imported, and to just for us to realize like we have a huge abundance here locally. And actually now that we're working on New York, there's when you start to focus on the abundance in each place, it's actually pretty amazing what there is. But you have a huge hurdle to overcome with people, especially people living in northern climates, who really have this mindset that, it's all going to be about deprivation. And, what will they do without their, imported this or that in the middle of winter? And, people ate locally on this planet throughout all of history until very recently. And it can be done with a great amount of pleasure, a great amount of nutrition and joy. And the reconnection with the seasons is actually a gift. It's actually a wonderful thing that we can experience. And there's no reason to have a dour look about it.
And maybe you can speak to that point. Why is it important for us from not just a flavor standpoint, but also from a nutrition and from an environmental standpoint to eat seasonally? One of the things I know that you do in your work is to try to really encourage people to know what food is in season. So, for example, on your local foods wheel, we see foods that are local or seasonal. When you go to the grocery store, you see apples coming from South America. And so maybe those apples have an organic label on it, but what are we weighing? What is the value in eating an organic apple if, in fact, it's traveled 3,000 miles? So in your work, when you talk about seasonal food, how do you help people get to that place where they understand the value?
This was really what I tried to do with my book, to sort of romance all of this and for us to rediscover just that being connected to the planet, being connected to our place and time is actually a wonderful feeling. It's not the sort of the illusion of the supermarket, of everything, of all that abundance and everything being there. It tricks us, and we sort of feel good about, we live in America and we have all this food, and I can have asparagus whenever I want it and all of that. But there's actually a loss that is experienced by that disconnection of not having a sense of the seasons, having a sense of the year. And it's not just the vegetables. I mean, even eggs, for example, on traditional family farms, you wouldn't really have too many eggs in the winter, because when the nights are long, chickens don't lay that much. It's a hormonal thing. And so what we do in our factory farms is we just keep the lights on. So the chickens never know whether it's summer, winter, spring, or fall, and they lay all year long. But if you're really eating pastured eggs like we do in our business buying pastured eggs, you see this huge dip in the quantity that's available, and in some cases the price is going up, which is interesting to see a price start to shift, you know, which is something we're completely unused to, you know, in our supermarket economy. But you'll see, you know, the egg quantity really dipped during the winter, and then in the spring, all of a sudden, all these eggs are here. You know, and that's why it was called the egg moon, was that that was the time of year when you had this abundance of eggs. And so your diet really moved through the year with nature and with these natural processes and with the animals that ate different things. The butter in spring is very different from the butter in fall, and there's reasons for that. And our ancestors experienced that, and I think that's a gift, and I think the loss of that is a loss.
I would agree. It's a very sad loss. And I hope, you know, that I think there's a kind of a renaissance today. I think people were at a tipping point where people want to know where their food comes from, and the surge in organics and the return to the family farm and the growth in community-supported agriculture. I think we're just sort of at that place where people want to know about their food sources. And I'd be curious, Helene, I know you work with a number of chefs, and I wanted to know, you know, sort of their reaction when you took away the cheeseburgers, you know, and also how diners responded to that.
Well, we didn't take away cheeseburgers. I think what you're referring to probably was Low Carbon Diet Day, which we hosted at our 400 cafes on Earth Day in April. And it really was an experiment. It was the first time we had shown to our guests what this program was about. We taught the chefs a year earlier, and we gave them an opportunity to prepare. And what that meant was trying out different things, trying out smaller seafood species, for instance, the low trophic species that are much better for both cleaning the oceans as well as healthy foods and don't take more marine resources to grow than they provide. So our chefs were a little perplexed when we first told them about this program in the summer of 2007. And it took a while for them to really separate local food and low-carbon food, because they see the connection and they feel very strongly that there is a connection. And let me just say that the connection is not so much about food now. You can't necessarily be guaranteed that the meat or the cheese or the produce that you buy that's produced locally is better from a climate change perspective. That's something that comes from far away. But it is important to invest in our regional infrastructure to be able to produce and distribute local and regional foods efficiently. Forever. And that is fundamentally how we're going to get ourselves to a food system that is a much lower producer of greenhouse gas emissions. So I can make a culinary argument or a gastronome's argument for eating local food. And I can also make an argument that if you really know the producers that you're buying from, you know they are stewards of the land and the sea, and that's critically important. But even from a climate change perspective, this is really about an investment in the future. And it was those kind of messages that I think the chefs understood. Wait a minute, this is part of the big picture. This is who we are. And we want to not only preserve local farms and local food for flavor reasons, but we need to be able to preserve the entire planet's ability to be able to produce food at sufficient quantities in the future. And you know what? They just went with it. We had a corporate goal of reducing our purchases of beef and cheese each by 10% within a year. We hit our target on cheese, and our chefs got it down to 23% reduction in 1 year on beef, and they did not substitute lamb, which was not allowed. And that had everything to do with their commitment, but it also had to do with the trust that a lot of their guests have that they're eating good food. Wheaton College was among those that actually did reduce over 50%. They kept the natural beef, all the natural beef, and they kept the grass-fed that was in the system. It's not available nationally, so they couldn't do that everywhere, but where they had it, they protected that. But they got rid of a lot of the hamburgers. And yeah, there was some resistance in some places, but overwhelmingly, people said, you know what, I can give up a hamburger once a week or twice a week. I don't have to eat that. I can eat some other things. And I think they accepted tasting some new flavors. We know they have because people aren't leaving the cafes.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing ways to eat right. Joining me in this discussion are Helene York, director of the Bon Appetit Management Company Foundation, Kevin Lunny, co-owner and president of Drake's Bay Oyster Farm, and Jessica Prentice, co-founder of Three Stone Hearth. I'd like you all to perhaps think a little bit for the audience about the common claim that organic food or naturally raised food is expensive, and that the average person can't afford to eat right, and that foods that are good for us are only for the few, while foods that are cheap are for people of a lower economic class. So what are the things that we can see or do in each of your roles in particular, but on a larger socioeconomic level, to bring good foods, to help people of all backgrounds eat the right way? Jessica, maybe you want to start.
It's funny how this question always comes up, and I think it's important to talk about it on two levels. One, as there being some significant issues that we have to look at in our culture around food distribution and access, which are important. But I also think we really need to look at it as an issue of perception, too, and the kind of story that we tell and the expectation that we have in this culture that food should be cheap, and that cheap food means that everybody is well fed. And we have to put that alongside that we also live in a culture where it's almost mandatory to have a cell phone, and we have the kinds of technologies that everybody has to have, from iPods to flat screen TVs to and not even technologies, but the stuff we have around appearances, the nice haircuts, manicures, the $300 shoes. We don't say that any of these things are too expensive or that any of these things are elitist. Our story in this culture is that those things are who we are as Americans and part of the American way of life and the cars and the gas and all of these things. And I would just like to make the argument that good food, the kind of food that we've been talking about, real food, is absolutely essential. Whereas all of these other things that I've been mentioning are not. They're actually optional. And that we need to have a shift in perception, too, in this culture, that food is one of the very few things that we actually need to survive. And that truly nourishing food is not only just, it's not just about a survival thing, it's actually the only true form of health insurance that we could really have, that ensures our health beforehand rather than tries to patch us up after we're already sick. And that our health problems in this culture are, I believe, very directly related to the lack of nutrients in our food system that is completely associated with the cheapness of our food. And there's lots of books that explain those connections, and they're very, very, very real. Even the difference between grass-fed beef and feedlot beef, we've already talked about the environmental differences, but in terms of the nutrient density of those two foods, you see a huge, huge difference, not to mention the toxicity of feedlot beef, where that are fed a prophylactic hormones or antibiotics, which then get taken in by the body and cause health problems. So our whole cheap food system comes with this huge price tag, which is our progressive destruction of the environment and our progressive destruction of our health, and that's never factored in. And so I would just really like us to stop this notion that food should be cheap. Food is precious, and real good food is precious. And there's a wonderful sort of old-fashioned British word, which is dear. Something that's precious is dear, and something that's dear is expensive. You can say that something, when you say something is dear in England, you also mean that it's expensive. And so we have to sort of admit that to produce food the way that will sustain the planet and sustain us is going to be, in our false economy, more expensive. It's more dear, it's more precious, but ultimately, in terms of the cost to us as a culture and the cost to us as a species on the planet and the cost to us as human beings who want to thrive and feel well and raise healthy children, there's just no choice. It's priceless. It's, you know, good food is priceless. And so if we really want to talk about the economic structure of our society and people's lack of access, there's huge things that we can discuss that are really, really important. There are huge numbers of people who live in neighborhoods where they don't have access to produce at all. And this is tragic. But there are also lots of little pockets of not wealthy immigrants who have backyard chickens, who they go and they just, they still know how to just, you know, snap the neck and put it in the stew pot and cook it up and feed the family. And it doesn't have to be expensive in a commodity sense. But if it's not expensive in terms of how much money we shell out for it, it requires a different level of commitment, like having a backyard chicken does, of saying, this is important. Food is incredibly important, and I'm going to put my time, I'm going to put my energy, or for some of us, my money, towards that, knowing that that is an investment that is just exponential in what it pays off. We can't even calculate what it pays off. It's a subject I care about a lot.
You're very passionate about it, and I think it's really informative, so thank you. And Kevin, do you have any thoughts to add to that?
I don't think I can add very much. That was beautiful. I can say that we are trying to bring some of our products costs down. We've moved into really broad scale, huge scale processing and manufacturing and shipping, and we really want to see more processing facilities returning into local communities, and I think that's going to help with the cost of our food, too.
Yeah, I think that question is most often positioned at farmers markets, like why is the organic produce at farmers markets so expensive? And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we don't subsidize our farmers who produce good vegetables, that we subsidize farmers who produce grains that our animals eat. But, you know, there's another piece to this, too, and that is over the past 25 years, the consumption of food in this country has gone up so dramatically, 18%, I believe, in the last 25 years. And that's what we actually eat. It doesn't even include what we don't eat. I mean, we buy so much food that we don't eat. And it is often because something looks bruised or is a little bit too mushy after a while, or the expiration date, which is somewhat artificially set in a lot of cases, has passed. And we waste at least 25% on a national average of the food we actually purchase. That doesn't even include the food that's been lost along the supply chain, because of these long transportation hauls, because of our, as consumers, need, perceived need to have beautiful food. If you go to a produce section of a supermarket, you will see workers throwing out food that is perfectly good. And they're throwing it out because they know that it's a little squished and consumers aren't going to buy it, and the whole display isn't going to look as good if there is something that is bruised. And so I think also as to echo what's already been said, but I just want to amplify on one point, and that is we have to have a new conversation about food and its importance. And the idea that we produce about 50% more food than we actually eat or should eat is really a big contributor to extra costs and not, of course, obesity and health concerns and everything else, but it is a significant contributor to cost. It doesn't have to be that way.
I have a number of questions from the audience, and I think maybe, Kevin, you could help answer them, just around the questions of what does grass-fed mean? If you could just define for the audience the difference between grass-fed, what that means, is it wholly grass-fed? And then also maybe you could address in your answer how does grass-fed beef help with carbon sequestration?
Okay. That can be a tricky one because you will see marketing that this beef is grass-fed and grain finished. And so that doesn't meet the red face test for grass-fed. Grass-fed is an animal's only fed grass. And it's really important for the lipid profile in the meat. It actually, the fats are completely different. They're all healthy fats. It's high in omega-3 fatty acids, high in conjugated linoleic acids. And so the health parts are critical that it's only had grass throughout its entire life. I touched a little bit on the carbon sequestration part in that by keeping that animal on grass, we're not tilling fields, opening up soils to lose carbon. We're not using petroleum-based fertilizers to grow the grain. We're not burning the fuel in the tractors to grow the grain. So those particular, you know, direct costs of carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, and also the transportation, because we don't move these animals around. They're born and raised, and they stay on the farm where they were grown. So I think those are a couple of the reasons that I think they play a big role.
Here's a great question, too, and I know that it's been touched upon. But the question is, when I visit my local farmer's market to buy local organic food, the vendors are often traveling 150-plus miles. Doesn't that imply a large carbon footprint? Maybe, Helene, you want to answer that?
The answer is it can, and I think that any purchaser of local foods or foods at a farmer's market, we should ask, where are the farmers coming from? Many times farmers bring small vehicles. They don't bring that much product, and they have come from even more than 150 miles. Different farmers' markets have different rules, and it isn't entirely efficient, but it's an interim step. I think we're at a phase now where we're really trying to figure out what we mean by local food and how we want to support it. And many times a farmer has come that distance because they don't have an outlet to sell their products where they are producing that food. And I think they deserve support too, but we certainly don't want them to come that distance. A writer, but let's look at it at the other end too, and that is, how far have you come in your car to go to the farmer's market? And that's a factor we have to consider. And then the last thing, just to complicate matters a bit more, is when you're talking about vegetables, distance matters. But because it's the distance that is much more of an effect on the carbon intensity, if you will, of a food than other factors. That's not true necessarily for meats and cheese, where it's the methane emissions from the growing of the animals that are a more significant factor. Farmers markets are a very good place to start. It's a great place to really start building community, but we also really should be encouraging, as a matter of policy, that farmers don't have to travel as far.
And I just want to point out that in California, the regulations are that all California certified farmers markets are only allowed to, there's only food sold that is grown in California, but it can be grown anywhere in California. So it could be coming up from the Imperial Valley or, you know, down from the border of Oregon, but it's, that's what the rule is. So basically, if you go to a farmer's market in California, you can be sure that it's grown in California, but it's not telling you anything about where. And so then you can ask more questions. And there's even, I mean, there's the opportunity to ask lots of questions. Like there's some farmers who bring their produce to the market using biodiesel. They've converted all their trucks to biodiesel. And so that's going to make a difference too. And that's the beauty of farmers markets is there's the opportunity for those conversations to happen and for you to go to another deeper level.
So we've come to the point in our program where we just have time for one more question. And I'd like for each of you to perhaps give the audience a sense of one thing that they can do in their day-to-day life that would help them perhaps eat the right way. Kevin.
The audience probably knows more about this than I do. I think a lot of this has already been said. I think it's an awareness. I think... Simply put, I think farmers market could play a huge role. It's a great place to learn. Even in our own small community of Point Reyes in West Marin, where Marin County, that's the kind of the center of agriculture in Marin, where our county is 20% certified organic, and it's leading the nation. Yet we marvel at how few people come to the farmers market, neighbors and friends that we would really expect to be there. The very same people that if they did come and began to educate themselves, it would be a great first step.
I think the eating the right way is really about looking at the future of eating right. It's about valuing food. It's about enjoying what's on our plates. It's about putting more vegetables there, preferably as local as possible from producers that we understand how good stewards they are of the land and fish from local purveyors as well. It's really about building and rebuilding regional food systems. We need it here. The Ecuadorians who send us bananas need it there. And if we are buying foods from far away, we are actively discouraging regional rebuilding of food systems in other parts of the world. So I think that is really the key to not only reducing climate change impacts, but really about the future of safe food, healthy food, and affordable food.
Well, I want to echo both of those things because I think I agree with both of them and could have said either one of those. But since I'm going third, I just want to add another layer, which is may sound corny, but I actually think that if we stop before we eat each time and take a moment to give thanks for what's in front of us, it starts to shift everything. And we start to move into a place of appreciation and gratitude for gift, not just for food, not just as a commodity, but as a gift, as a blessing, as something that's sacred and that deserves our attention, our respect, our stewardship. And we live in a culture where we don't really like to, you know, be religious or you know, spiritual or any of that. But we do this at lunch at my kitchen every day, and I can't tell you the difference that it makes in terms of just shifting our attitude about what it is that we do with our day and with our work and what our work means, and just remembering that we live in this amazing mystery that we call life and that everything's connected in these ways that we don't understand. And just sitting down to a meal is the perfect time to sort of step back and move into that space of gratitude and blessedness and giftedness and magic. And I think that that's a great starting place. And once you're doing that, then you want to go to the farmer's market and you don't want to buy bananas from Ecuador anymore. It just, everything just starts to shift.
Thank you so much to our panelists, Kevin Lunny, co-owner and president of Drake's Bay Oyster Farm, Jessica Prentice, co-founder of Three Stone Hearth, Helene York, director of the Bon Appetit Management Company Foundation. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. This program is part of our How We Eat series, a month-long series of programs that take an in-depth look at our eating habits, health, and the mechanisms surrounding how we get our food. I am Naomi Starkman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.